Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening into Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with Adam Spruder, sitting in for George Allman and John Clements. We will be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Going to be another nice day, hopefully, out here. And we have a special guest with us today. We have Tom Spellman, formerly of Dave Wilson Nursery, our biggest bare root fruit tree supplier, one of the few that still services Southern California. And Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Always a pleasure to have you down. It's nice to see you. It's been a while since we've seen you in the store, so it's nice to have you back.
Well, feels good to be here.
Now, I mentioned that you were formerly with Dave Wilson Nursery. You have moved on to other organizations now. So where are you affiliated with now? I guess would be a
Right now I'm doing some consulting mm-hmm. for several different firms on growing fruit and regenerative studies throughout Southern California, and I'm also repping for a couple of growers, one in the Central Valley of California called Central Valley Growers, and they do a full line of fruit trees and shade trees. Persimmons, jujubes are a real specialty of theirs, so that's been a really good market.
That's what you were saying when before we came on the air, that you said that Central Valley grows the best persimmons and jujubes you've seen.
I've ever seen.
And absolutely, you've been in this, beautiful. You've been doing this for a long time.
Only 53 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, since I was just a teenager.
So I guess we could call you an expert in the field then at this point.
I guess so.
I know, at least in my case, it's safe to say that you have probably forgotten more than I ever knew about the fruit tree field. So.
Well, I've got a lot of practical experience. So
yes. Yeah. And who is the other
nursery? The other is Hayworth Nursery, and they're up in Gaston, Oregon. And they do a lot of trees, commercial pears, commercial apples, cherries for the fruit growing industry up there in Oregon and Washington. And they also do a full line of additional fruit trees and shade trees for the retail market. So between the two, I kind of have a real good selection of both low chill material for Southern California and higher chill material for, you know, the upper Midwest and colder climates.
Well, even in the mountain areas around Southern California too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we have a lot of clients, a lot of customers that we bring in higher chill stuff in the Poway store that we don't stock at the San Diego store for the folks that live up in Ramona, up in your neighborhood, Adams, and even farther east up into the mountains around Julian, Winola, area.
And I know we've done some material in the past for you guys, custom order material for a couple of clients up on Palomar Mountain. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. And that's about as high as you can get in San Diego.
Yeah.
up on Palomar. I know before we came on the air, one of the things that we were talking about, and I know you helped contribute some of the information that we have in our fruit tree pruning book and home orchard growing.
Well, home orcharding has been a passion of mine for many years. And, you know, I'm involved both with the commercial facets of the industry and what people are doing in their backyard. You know, the commercial industry is pretty solid. They have their methodology down. They have their consultants. They know what they're doing and do everything on a very timely schedule. Backyard growing is completely different. You know, we have so many different microclimates in Southern California and so many different preferences on what people are growing. So it's been a little more of a, I wouldn't say a challenge, but just needs a little more research, and, you know, people need to pay a little bit more attention to their soil types and, you know, their irrigation patterns and just, you know, what they're doing on a backyard scale in order to be successful.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about the soil types, because that's one thing that, you know, 30 years ago that never would have occurred to me in this business. I think mainly because it just wasn't as prevalent, is the different rootstocks.
Absolutely.
And how those rootstocks are tailored for different soil types. And you can get the same plant on different rootstocks for different areas.
Yes. Yes.
And we do try to tailor our fruit tree selection with the rootstocks that will do best in the areas that we serve.
Well, that's an extremely important concept. And, you know, we grow, say, Santa Rosa plum on four or five different rootstocks, mm-hmm. you know, some that are adaptable to desert sandy soils and hot conditions, some that are adaptable to heavy wet soils, some that are adaptable to colder climates that take down to 20 below zero. So this, the Santa Rosa plum itself is very adaptable, but if you don't have it on the right rootstock for your area, you can fail with it. So understanding those rootstocks and understanding your individual microclimate is extremely important.
You know, there's been a lot of change in the industry in the bare root as a whole over the past decade or so. I, as a kid growing up in the business, our two big suppliers for bare root fruit trees were Ellie Cook, which is gone permanently gone as of last year.
Yes.
And the other one that we used to get a lot from was Orange County Nursery, which also is gone. And I don't ever remember anybody talking about rootstock back then. It was, we got in plums, we got in peaches, we got in nectarines, we didn't even get cherries. Cherries are a relatively new introduction to Southern California, at least in our climates, that we're not, just typically not available because of the high chill requirement on it.
Right. And it's only been in about the last 15 years that Zager Hybrids has introduced some varieties that are adaptable to low chill conditions. So, mm-hmm. you know, we have Mini Royal, we have Royal Lee, we have Royal Crimson that are rated at about 300 chill hours.
That's so pretty low.
Yeah. Compared to Bings and Black Tartarians that were 700, 800, 900 chill hours. Mm-hmm. So now in areas of Southern California where nobody would have ever considered growing cherries before, we actually can grow successful.
Now, Adams, you have a pretty good selection of fruit trees out on your property in Ramona, correct?
I do. I have about 80 different varieties.
And are you growing cherries out there?
I just started a couple. I started Lappin's 2 years ago, got my first root this year, and then I put in a Brooks just this last bare root season to go with that. But yeah, as far as the low chill cherries go, I'm getting good reports from Carlsbad all the way to the beach for that Royal Crimson Cherry.
And really?
It is actually was their number one selling tree last year of all the varieties.
Interesting. When I started in this, I never would have thought. It's really interesting how things have progressed. And one of the great things about home orcharding is that you can grow a lot of stuff in a relatively small space. I think a lot of people used to think that if you planted a peach tree or a peach tree or a nectarine or a plum tree in most yards in Southern California, that meant one plant or two plants. But with home orcharding, you can do more in a smaller space.
Absolutely. You know, if you look at what a commercial grower is looking for in a peach tree. So, you know, if I was growing peaches up in Tulare County, I would be looking at harvesting 250 to 350 pounds of fruit off of each tree. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, as we know, all those stone fruits ripen up over about a 10-day or 2-week period of time. So if I have a standard sized, you know, full sized orchard tree in my backyard and I'm getting 250 pounds of peaches, am I going to be able to use those in a 2-week period of time? So what backyard orcharding recommends is that you grow a size controlled tree. I don't need 250 pounds of peaches, but if I were to take four different varieties, say a May variety, a June variety, a July variety, and an August variety, and put those in the place of one standard size orchard tree. Now I can harvest 50 or 75 fruit off of each one of those over an extended period of time. And that's what my family is going to be able to use. They can't use 250 all in 1 or 2 weeks, but over a 2.5 or 3 month period, they can definitely use 50 or 75 at a
time. Yeah, I remember as a kid, my grandparents had a Babcock peach in their backyard, and that tree would produce so much fruit. It was incredible how much, and it would all ripen pretty much at the same time. That was one of those ones that if you didn't thin it, it would destroy itself.
Oh, absolutely.
It would set so much fruit that it would tear itself apart. But I know my grandmother was giving peaches away, taking them to the nursery and freezing tons of peaches from that tree. It produced an insane amount of fruit all at one time. And I think that's the way people used to look at it back then. But with these new theories and these new techniques, you can definitely make it more manageable and get more variety out of it.
You know, and not only are we growing trees on tighter spacings and keeping them size controlled, there's also a fair amount of material out there that is now what we call a multiple budded tree. So you can take a peach rootstock and you can graft in two or three or four different varieties of peach that ripen at different times. So you can extend your harvest, into 2.5 months or so with just one tree with multiple varieties grafted.
Yeah, that's been a very interesting concept of the things that have been coming through with the multi-grafts. I know peaches were popular for that. Apples, multi-graft apples. I thought we had other multi-grafts too. Did we not?
Yeah, we still have a few multi-grafts left, but we got in a lot of the different multi-grafts this year. So,
and we'll be getting more of those again.
Absolutely.
Again this year. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruder, John Clements, and our special guest, Tom Spellman. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruder, John Clements, and our special guest, Tom Spellman, fruit tree guru in California, I would say. And we've been talking about home orcharding and home orcharding, rootstocks, and things like that. And Adams, you brought up an interesting thing about what customers are looking. One of the things customers are looking for in rootstocks, which is something that it helps, but it's not a cure-all.
Customers often specifically looking for a dwarfing rootstock. They're not considering the other more important characteristics of that rootstock, like how it adapts to soil and climate. And they're not realizing that even if it's semi-dwarfing, that alone isn't going to control the size of their tree for them. If they want to control the size of the tree, it's up to them to keep that tree cut and maintained, as even though semi-dwarfing rootstocks are still going to be a fairly large tree.
Yeah, that's a great consideration, Adams. You know, one of the things that people always think is, oh, if I get this semi-dwarfing tree, it's going to be this perfect little lollipop that's never going to get any bigger than my perceived size. And that's really untrue. Most semi-dwarfing rootstocks are only dwarfed by about 15 or 20%. So if you have a standard tree that's going to get up to 20 or 25 feet, you now have a semi-dwarf that's probably going to be in the 16 to 20 foot range. So that's still twice the size of a tree that I want to grow in my orchard.
That's a big tree.
Yeah. Oftentimes over the years, I've had people come back to me and say, well, you guys sold me the wrong tree. I bought a semi-dwarf and it's 15 feet tall, but that's a semi-dwarf. So the most important things to consider, two things. Number one, make sure that the rootstock you're getting your tree grafted on is a rootstock that's adaptable to your climate and a rootstock that's adapted to your soil type. So like I said earlier on Santa Rosa plum, we use multiple different rootstocks to grow different varieties on. So you want to make sure that it's going to take your conditions. And then you are the one that chooses the size of your tree. So you always want to be able to accept responsibility for how big that tree is going to get. If I want a tree that's only going to be 10 feet tall and it's on a rock that's going to grow to 15 or 20, I know that every year I'm going to have to prune that tree back and keep it size managed. So just be willing to accept that responsibility. And the nice thing about size management is it's not rocket science. You know, you don't have to look for detail. All you have to do is choose a size, prune the tree down to that size. And then in fall or in the winter, you're going to come in and you're going to do your detail work and you've got a beautiful tree for the next season.
And I want to emphasize on that when you're controlling the size of that tree, you're often doing that pruning work throughout the growing season, throughout the summer, versus selecting for the fruiting wood and pruning out diseased wood or damaged wood in the wintertime.
Absolutely. So, you know, summer pruning for size control is simply that. All you're doing is choosing a manageable size. And that's normally done sometimes before fruit season, sometimes after fruit season, depending on how early or how late the variety ripens. But just be willing to accept the responsibility to keep the trees pruned to that size. I always go back in the fall around September, October, early November, and look for detail issues. Is there broken branches? Or is the growth too dense and toward the center? Is something growing out of balance at that time? Is there deadwood, broken? And you're going to do your detail work at that time. That summer pruning in June, July, or August is simple. It's just strictly size control.
You know, one of the other things that I know about pruning in June, July, or August as compared to the traditional pruning seasons of November or December is it's not cold, rainy, and miserable when you're doing it in the summertime. And it's not nearly as unpleasant as it can be in the wintertime.
Oh, absolutely. I would much rather go out on a, you know, September morning when it's 75 degrees and do a little size control pruning than in January when it's cold and rainy or windy or, you know, whatever the conditions are.
Well, you know, and talking about pruning for size, that starts from the minute that you put the plant in the ground as well. Because you come into the nursery, say you buy a peach tree and you take home a whip that's 7 or 8 feet tall. And if you want to keep it at a managed dwarf, I guess you could call it, you don't want to put it in the ground at 6 or 7 feet. You want to cut it down. You want to shorten the main leader on it so that you don't start out with a giant tree or a large tree to begin with.
Exactly. And that cut is the most difficult cut for people to make. Because, you know, they just spent good money on a tree that's 7 feet tall and you're telling them, I want you to make that tree 3.5 or 4 feet.
Yeah.
And the resistance is incredible, but that is by far the most important cut they'll ever make. It's much, much easier to keep a small tree small than it is to make a big tree small.
That you have got that right. That is a tremendous amount of work to go through and, try to reverse something that has gotten out of hand.
Yeah, and it happens all the time. You know, I've worked with people over the years that, we planted these trees 10 years ago and we really didn't do any pruning on them. So now they're all 15 to 20 feet tall. What can we do? And there's, you know, several options, but the easiest one and, you know, the easiest way to make that correction is to cut it down to 3 feet and regrow the entire structure. Mm-hmm. So they're basically going back to square one and starting over with that tree, where if had they done that year after year and kept that tree at a manageable size, it would have been, you know, much easier and they're not going to lose 1 or 2 years worth of crop then.
Now, I might be mistaken, but I was under the impression that even in the Central Valley where you have commercial orchards growing, that they will do that periodically. They will come through and severely prune back the orchards and basically just regenerate and start over again.
Absolutely. That's done tens of thousands of times every year in the commercial industry. They want to make sure that they're keeping those trees manageable and they want to make sure that they're keeping that fruiting wood rejuvenated all the time. So once they get 6, 8, 10 years worth of growth on a tree, they'll come down and bring it down to just a single trunk or a couple of scaffolding branches and regrow the whole structure.
I remember as a kid, you don't see it so much now, but they used to do that in the avocado orchard here in San Diego. They would take these huge trees and come, then you'd come back and all the trees were just, the smallest branch was 3 or 4 inches in diameter and everything was painted white to keep it from sunburning, and they would just let it refoliate and start over again.
Yeah, and that's very common in avocados and citrus as well.
Yeah. Now, also in the Central Valley, they will switch out trees in orchards over after a period of years where they will just replant the entire orchard too, correct?
Yes, that happens on a regular basis. The commercial life expectancy of an almond or a peach or an apricot is about 15 years.
So okay.
Once a tree reaches its peak in production and starts to go back down the other way, then they will choose an improvement. Maybe they're looking for a different variety. Maybe they're looking for an improved root system. So they'll take out orchards, clean up the soil, clean up the area, and replant with them. That happens all the time.
That is very interesting. And it's something you wouldn't really think about. You would think that you put it in and you just let it keep going.
Well, you know, that's a very common with stone fruit varieties because they do have a fairly short life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
The citrus and avocado guys are kind of in a different position because citrus and avocado trees can outlive us.
Yes. So
they don't do that on a regular basis. Each plum, nectarine, apricot, almond, that's done on a regular basis.
You know, John, we were talking about it a little bit before we got on the air. One of your favorite fruits is the spicy nectar plum, and almost got into a knockdown with somebody online over it. And their biggest issue with it was the
flower cat facing.
The western flower thrip.
Right.
Now, Tom, you had said that there's actually it's a relatively easy thing to control on them.
Oh, absolutely. Western flower thrip damage occurs when the fruit is about the size of a green pea. You know, mm-hmm. from the end of the flower stage to a very, very small pea size. So you can treat with a horticultural oil, with a neem oil, with an organic OMRI registered product like spinosad. And if you get a couple of applications on, one at about 90% flower and the other about a week or 10 days later, you'll have no western flower thrip damage at all. The fruit begins to mature, the damage is already there and it's already done. So you can't control it late. It has to be controlled early, right at that end of flower stage.
That would make sense mm-hmm. that the scarring occurs when the fruit is relatively small right. and then it grows into the scarring, I guess you could say.
Right, right. The damage is done early. The thrip is almost microscopic. You know, you really can't even see it when it's doing its damage. So, you know, controlling it at that end of flower stage is a must.
I'd love to know too, Tom. I mean, so I love the Zager intergenerics. I mean, they're just, I don't think there's anything better than what Floyd Zager was doing. I mean, the nectar plums, the pluots, the apriums, all these pluaries. George Allman brought us some pluaries last time we recorded.
Those were good.
My gosh, is that a good piece of fruit?
Absolutely.
And I'd love to know if we were to just go through maybe the main fruits, would be your favorite apple?
Oh, my favorite apple, it depends on what
season
is.
Southern California. Folks.
So there's several good varieties. One of my favorites, especially for San Diego County, is a variety called Sundowner.
Mm.
And Sundowner is a sister plant to Pink Lady. It mm-hmm. came out of the same hybridization program, but just a delicious piece of fruit, very low chill adaptable, late season harvest, hangs on the tree for a long time. So I'm a big fan of Sundown.
And favorite peach?
Oh, Mid Pride.
Okay.
Definitely Mid Pride.
That is a good one.
Yeah, ripe in July, very reliable, big orange freestone, just, you know, wonderful flavor.
Nectarine?
Nectarine. Probably Snow Queen. I really like Snow Queen. It's an old Armstrong variety, been around for years. Not sub-acid like a lot of the newer varieties. It has a really good, true, balanced sugar to acid.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the treats. I think maybe Adams, you corroborate this. I think in the San Diego area, it's very difficult for people to find a good apricot to grow. Is there an apricot that you would recommend for San Diego?
Before we get into that, we need to take a quick break. So we'll be talking to Tom about apricots when we come back. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruder, John Clements, and our special guest, Tom Spellman. So if you want to learn more about apricots, stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruder, sitting in for George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Tom Spellman. And we've been talking about fruit trees. And just before the break, we were going to get into discussion about apricots and what apricots do well in San Diego. And growing up in this business, I would say out of all the fruit trees varieties that we sell, apricots were the least consistent as far as producing in Southern California is concerned.
Well, first of all, you have to consider that most apricot varieties are fairly alternate bearing. So you're going to get good years and bad years.
Okay.
And most of the varieties up until recently were also not necessarily low chill. You know, Blenheim or Royal was by far the most popular variety in California. And It actually rates at about 500 chill hours.
And that one works really well for me in Ramona.
If you get a solid 400 to 500 or more chill hours, it's going to be a knockout variety. It's going to be incredible.
Absolutely.
But there have been a few others that have been hybridized over the years, including some apriums that have a little bit of plum parentage in them. And that's a Floyd Zager hybrid. So some of my favorites there would be a variety called Cotton Candy, which is a white aprium. Flavor Delight, which is has apricot plum parentage in it and very, very adaptable to low chill conditions. And another one that I really like, very large size, kind of a mid-season variety called Leacot. So those apriums are all excellent selections in San Diego. But again, I don't know that I would recommend them for Oceanside or Point Loma. But if you can get 15 or 20 miles inland, you're going to do just fine. There have also been some new selections coming out. One of them that we'll be introducing soon is a variety called White Knockout. That has some Armenian apricot parentage in it. It's a blonde or a blushed apricot and very, very reliable under low chill conditions. And the interesting thing is all apricots are basically self-fruitful. They don't require a cross-pollinate. But if you incorporate two varieties that bloom simultaneously, you can get five times the amount of fruit. So apricots are one of those categories where I would say you always want to try and incorporate at least two varieties or do a multiple planted combination or a multiple budded tree.
That's interesting. I had not heard that before about the multiple, thank you, John. I was wondering what that was. About planting two varieties of the same thing, kind of like you, with the A and B avocados, although the difference in production isn't quite as big on avocados. I know that one of the apricots that was really kind of a game changer for us when it came out was Katie.
Yes.
Which was a relatively low chill apricot, but it still had that alternate bearing thing where you'd get a good crop and then you'd in a not so good crop.
Right. Yeah. You know, all those low chill selections, Katie, Gold Kissed, Tropic Gold, they're all going to have an alternate tendency. So you get a good year, maybe two good years in a row, and then a light year. So there's always going to be a disappointing year from time.
I know. We planted a Katie in our backyard a number of years ago, and it did okay. The first couple of years it was growing okay. Didn't get a lot of production off of it. And then one year it started growing like crazy. And I realized that it was the rootstock that had taken over. We had a beautiful apricot tree out in our backyard, but it only got one apricot off of it the entire time that it was there. It is now moved on. It is no longer in the air, but beautiful tree. Really, really pretty tree.
They are pretty tree. They have kind of a nice spreading habit to them, and you know, very easy to keep low canopy on those. They're great backyard selections just because they're so easy to manage.
Yeah, I think even when it was growing from the rootstock, I don't think ours ever got more than about 12 feet. And I really didn't prune it that much. It just maintained its own shape and style. And like you said, that low spreading habit, it was a very striking tree.
Yeah, and there's not much better than fresh apricot jam.
Mm-hmm. Another variety I've really enjoyed is Florigold, although I haven't found production's been too high on it. But the flavor is phenomenal. It ripens really evenly. I found it doesn't burn on one side in the sun like some of the others do.
Well, here's the interesting thing about Florigold. Number one, it blooms for an extended period.
It definitely does.
So that is a great pollinator variety for most other apricots. It's going to catch early, mid-season and late blooming varieties.
Absolutely. So, I get about 6 weeks of bloom on mine.
Right. And also it tends to produce more of an even crop and is probably less alternate than most varieties. You're not going to get a heavy bumper crop and then a real light crop. You're going to get more even consistent crop.
Exactly. I've noticed that too. It's not a heavy crop. It's a light crop, but it's consistent, nice, large, excellent flavored fruit.
Absolutely. That's a good variety.
You know, one of the things that used to be pretty popular, and we just don't see it as much. We just don't see it around as much as we used to a number of years ago. But it's probably my favorite of a true plum variety, Green Gage. I think it might have been you that was telling me that most of what is Green Gage now is actually a Japanese green plum that's out there.
Yes, you know, the true Green Gage selections are European plums. They bloom very late, and for the most part, they're fairly high chill.
Mm-hmm.
So, the true selections are kind of stingy in this area, but there were a couple of green fruiting selections that were grown over the years that were marketed as Green Gage, but were more along the lines of a Shiro type Japanese plum.
I know my grandparents had they always called it Green Gage plum in their yard in Bay Park. And that was another one that produced an unbelievable amount of fruit, just an insane amount of fruit, way more than they could ever keep up with. And that was one that you could harvest the fruit where it wasn't fully ripe yet, still edible, just much more tart. And the longer you left it on the tree, that ended up being like little water balloons full of sugar water. It got so sweet, but the skin remained tart. That was one of my favorites growing up, was that green plum that my grandparents had.
Yeah, some of those green selections are really, you know, excellent quality. One of my favorites is a pluot variety called Emerald Drop.
I've heard of that one.
It's phenomenal fruit.
Oh, absolutely. Emerald Drop is very low chill adaptable and, you know, produces like a madman. And it holds on the tree for a long period of time. So where most plum varieties are going to give you 10 days or 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, I've had Emerald Drop hold for as long as 6 weeks.
Mm.
And it just gets better and better and better the longer it hangs on.
I've been eating mine for about a month now. So
now with fruiting varieties of plums, do they, I should know this, but being in the business, do they have as short a lifespan as like the Thundercloud, the red leaf plum? Will really start to fade pretty quickly after about 15 years or so.
Yeah, I would say most of the fruiting plum varieties aren't as susceptible to Xylella as the red leafed varieties. Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to get a little more. It's not uncommon for a homeowner to get 20, 25, or 30 years out of a backyard fruiting plum, but seldom are the red leaf varieties going to last more than 10 or 15.
That's been my experience with them as well.
Yeah, and that's a Xylella. It's a strain of Pierce's disease.
It just keeps attacking more and more things, it seems like.
Right? Yeah, olives are being wiped out. Whether it's verticillium or xylella, there's debate, but olive trees look horrible all over San Diego now. I wouldn't even plant an olive.
Well, oleanders have pretty much disappeared from the landscape.
Yeah.
The first thing that took out the oleanders was oleander gall. Mm-hmm. And that wiped out the wholesale industry for a long time. And then they came back, and then the xylella came in. And then the xylella, the Pierce's disease, that's done its fair share of damage. Almost wiped out the grape market in Temecula for a long time.
Yeah, there's, grape strain. There's a strain that attacks liquid ambers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, we're seeing it more and more lately.
Yeah, I completely agree.
As far as the red leaf plums go, I had a tree when I moved in that was completely dead, but I had rootstock suckers coming up. I grafted 3 plum varieties on there. Now I've got fruiting plums growing more like a bush right out in my front yard.
Good for you. Take advantage.
Yeah. Absolutely. I already had an established root system. They were fruiting by the second year.
Yeah. You've got a good motor. So, put a car on it.
Yeah. We had a red leaf plum in our front yard at the house that I'm in now. And when it got mature, my kids realized that it actually produced fruit, which it doesn't produce a lot, but it does produce some fruit, and it's small. I didn't care for it, but man, they would climb into that tree and search that fruit out, and they would eat that. They would eat pretty much anything that tree produced.
How about a favorite Japanese plum as a pollinator? Well, a lot of the pluots, you either have to have another pluot that blooms at similar time, but it's frequently recommended get a Japanese plum. Do you have a favorite?
Absolutely, John. My favorite Japanese plum by far is Burgundy. Burgundy, it's not a big fruit. It's a medium sized to small fruit, but produces like a madman. And again, it blooms for a long extended period of time. So Burgundy is a great pollinator variety as well as a great fruit variety within itself.
And Burgundy plum has fragrant blooms as well.
Oh, no kidding.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it does. Yep.
Wow.
You get 2 birds with 1 stone with that. It's kind of like Red Baron Peach.
Yeah.
You get a spectacular flower set before the fruit comes along. So you get the best of both worlds with that.
I have a couple of different commercial growers, farmers market, it's not large commercial scale. They're growing varieties like Burgundy Plum, Red Baron Peach, Saturn Peach, and they will do only summer pruning. And then during bloom period, they will cut the additional growth out that they don't want on the tree, take those to the farmer's market and sell them as floral spikes.
Oh.
So they're getting dual use out of those trees. They're using it as a floral item they can sell early in the season, and they get the fruit later in the season.
That is pretty innovative. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruder, John Clements, and our special guest, Tom Spellman. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruder, John Clements, and our special guest, Tom Spen. We've been talking fruit trees today. Adams, during the break, you were telling us an interesting story about one of your neighbors had a Saturn peach in his.
It wasn't a neighbor. It was a customer.
Or a customer.
Came in last bare root season. He had a Saturn peach. Fruit's great on that, but the blooms are so spectacular, a really bright pink double bloom. He said he had a tree probably about 4 inches in diameter. Someone came through his front yard and cut the tree off and stole the entire tree while it was blooming just for the blooms. And he was here to get another peach tree.
Wow.
That's incredible. That's a lot of effort for a few flowers.
That's gutsy.
For a short period of time.
A week.
Yeah, that's...
But it just goes to show how spectacular that variety can be. And it can be a good ornamental fruit-bearing variety you can put in your front yard and just have something spectacular. It's as ornamental a flower as some of the ornamental flowering peaches.
A lot of the deciduous fruit trees are an incredibly beautiful blooming almond trees when they're in bloom, pear trees, and just about any of them can be really, really pretty ornamental trees before the fruit actually sets. Mm-hmm. So they you accomplish two different things by planting those.
I think you want to really take into consideration that it's an edible ornamental. So you're getting a dual use out of it. You know, you're getting that beautiful flower. You're getting a nice fall color. Plus, you're getting a good quality fruit. So you've got varieties like Double Delight Nectarine, got Red Baron, Saturn Peach, Mid Pride Peach that are all double flowering and, really good fruit quality. So, those are varieties people really need to consider the beauty of their landscape as well as what they're harvesting on. I want to look at something nice as well as eat a good peach.
Well, the spicy nectar plum.
Oh, that's a great example.
Keeps its red foliage on it. Where a lot of peaches and nectarines will their new flush of growth will come out red, but it doesn't stay that way.
Right.
It fades to green.
Or the Hollywood plum. Hollywood plum,
too. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Red leaf Hollywood plum.
Yeah. Another incredibly popular fruit variety that we've seen just explode over the past 3 decades or so, I would say, is blueberry. And the amount of blueberries that are on the market today is incredible. And 35 years ago, there were no blueberries in Southern California. It wasn't available. We couldn't buy them. We couldn't sell them. Nobody was growing them. And all of a sudden, just within the past few decades, it is that particular fruit has exploded in popularity in Southern California. And it's really easy to grow.
Oh, blueberries are an incredible category, and we have three basic categories of blueberry. We have what we call Northern High Bush. They're mostly higher chill varieties that they would grow in the northern climates. And there, a lot of those were native species of blueberry. We have what they call a rabbit eye blueberry, which is a small shrubby bush, doesn't get very tall, but very prolific bearer. And then we have the newer varieties, which are called Southern High Bush. Mm-hmm. Most of those were developed by some of the Southern States universities, and they were grown or hybridized for their low chill adaptability. So we have a dozen or more varieties now for Southern California that produce blueberries from the size of a green pea to the size of a nickel. And, some of those varieties are just absolutely incredible. So the main considerations with blueberries are two things: drainage and keeping your soil an acidic pH. Mm-hmm. So as long as you have good drainage and a nice humic organic-based soil that you can keep a low pH below 7, 5.5 to 6.5 is probably the range you want to try and maintain. You will get a ton of blueberries from the end of February through about now.
Yeah, we've told people that if you plant a blueberry and you maintain it and you get it into the groove that it likes, they'll just about pay for themselves in one season with the amount of fruit that they put
absolutely.
Off.
Absolutely. I mean, 3 months worth of berries off of a plant. Very, very few fruit trees are going to give you 3 months worth.
So yeah, we have one, and I just recently, I kept it in a pot for years on the patio, just recently put it in the ground. When it was early in its life in the pot, when it was producing like crazy, it was producing more blueberries than we could eat in one sitting. So Melanie would just throw them into a baggie and throw them in the freezer. Real easy to keep that fruit. But we basically tell people, you just kind of treat it like a camellia or an azalea, and you're going to be in good shape. Try not to put it in full sun all day long, bright light, but the acidic soil is key.
Well, Ken, I've actually had mine in a very hot, sunny location.
Really?
I grow all of mine in half wine barrels.
Okay, yeah.
And I put two or three different varieties in a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I just grow them into one kind of a shrub. But the thing you want to consider with all those Southern High Bush blueberries, again, they're all self-fertile. They will all produce some fruit. But if you have two or three or four varieties together, you're going to get five, six, seven, eight times the amount of fruit.
Wow.
So cross-pollination is a must. Don't just plant one, plant several.
Good and, advice.
You
know,
you want to make sure that you've got them in an area where you can maintain that acidity and you have good, fast drainage. They mm-hmm. don't like stagnant soil.
And you had mentioned the southern highbush varieties. A lot of those came out of Florida.
Several were developed in Florida. Some were developed in Georgia, and they have just come up with some incredible selections.
Yeah, and Florida is the last place I would think about blueberries coming from.
It's the last place you would ever grow a northern blueberry, but you know it's an incredible climate for the southern variety. So we've got lots of great selections, and you guys carry most of those.
Yeah, so. we do carry a lot of blueberries, and it may be the most one of the most popular varieties of fruit that we sell these days.
I think it definitely is. We sell hundreds and hundreds of them, and we sell them year round here. There's so many good varieties.
You know, I think the other thing worth mentioning, they don't like high nitrogen, so you want to use a low nitrogen balanced fertilizer with trace elements, and preferably something with a humic acid base. And then, as far as pruning goes, they love to be pruned. They love to be rejuvenated. But you want to do all of your pruning right at the end of their fruiting season. So mm-hmm. when you're picking the last fruit, that's when you want to do some shaping and some pruning. And then you have another August, September, October, November, where you get that regrowth. And all of that regrowth is going to be your fruiting wood for the next season.
Exactly. So I never recommend people to prune their blueberries in the wintertime like their other mm-hmm. fruit trees.
Every cut you make after the middle of summer will actually take away fruiting potential for the next year. So never mm-hmm. fall or winter prune blueberry.
No, only summer advice. Prune
right after harvest season.
And San Diego has the worst water, maybe in the country. I mean, it's so full of salt. And so I recommend to people always use iron sulfate or sulfur to bring your mm-hmm. pH down. I like iron sulfate because you get the release of the nitrogen. Iron, but you're mm-hmm. also bringing the pH down, and we just can't get the acidity in that soil. Even if you're using an engineered soil, the one third mix, I find you have to use some form of sulfur to bring the pH down. But that said, you can be so productive.
It's an easy one to grow, and it doesn't take up a lot of space. Like you said, you can grow multiple plants in a half oak barrel,
three or four varieties in a half barrel, and nothing makes me happier than sitting out on my patio and watching my granddaughters graze on blueberries.
It is nice to be able to go out and just pick them off the plant and pop a handful in your mouth while you're out working in the yard.
Very few actually make it into the house.
And how about the length of time to stay in a barrel? I find after a couple of years, especially if I'm using the azalea camellia mix and bark and some sand maybe, or peat moss and coir, I find that it just gets a little muddy over time, and then they just get a little root bound. So I find I need to maybe every other year or so pull them out of the barrels, almost bare root them, and then replant them. Do you find that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I've done some experimenting over the years with the longevity of the plant in the barrel and the longevity of the barrel itself. Mm. And I found that after about four and a half, five years, the barrel is basically rotting away. Mm-hmm. So if I can maintain them in that barrel by maybe adding a little bit of media to them in the second or third year, and then when the barrel itself starts to decompose, just knock the rings off, mm-hmm. pull all the staves out. You've got a root ball that's already there. Set up a new barrel, put 6-inch new media in the bottom, drop that root ball back in, add some new media around the side. You've got another 3, 4, 5 years.
Okay.
I actually have some blueberry combinations that I've transplanted now two times, and they're about 12, 13 years old. Mm. As long as you're rejuvenating that, it seems to work out well. But you're right that you have almost a completely organic media, and that's going to decompose down to just kind of a sludgy mush.
Yeah, eventually.
Right.
And with blueberries, be careful you're not burying them too deep. Like to be planted high.
I like to be planted high. Yeah. When I plant my blueberries, I like to see the original outline of the container that they were growing right on the surface.
That's a good rule of thumb for just about
almost
just about
everything.
Just yeah. about every, except for, yeah. you know, tomatoes are the only thing that I can think of that likes to be buried deep,
right.
or will tolerate being buried deep, but everything else we want it at grade level or even slightly above,
yeah.
just a little bit above. You never want to pounding soil up against the trunk of a plant when you're planting it.
No.
In most cases, it's going to be the kiss of death for
it.
It's
the worst thing you can do. You always want to make sure you're just a little bit high.
Yeah. We're just about out of time today, but what do you predict is going to be the next big fruit tree introduction?
Oh, if you can. Boy. You know, in working with some of the hybridizers out there, there are so many new things on the market right now. They're doing a lot with cherry plum hybrids. So you will see in the next few years some cherry plum hybrids that are just going to blow you away. They're going to extend out the cherry harvest season into August and September.
Mm. Oh,
they're going to be cherry varieties that are the size of a small to medium plum.
Mm. Wow.
So I think there's going to be a lot of interest in some of the new cherry plum hybrids. I think there's going to be a lot of interest in some of the new apricots, like that white knockout mm-hmm. variety that I talked about. There's a lot of interest in what they call a saucer peach or a donut style mm-hmm. peach or donut style nectarines. And there are a lot of new varieties coming out along those lines. Many that are orange fleshed or red fleshed and extend much later into the season. So we've got some incredible new things on the horizon.
Tom, thank you very much for coming down and joining us today. We really appreciate and look forward to some of these new varieties coming in. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back next week with another hour. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.